We welcome our speaker tonight. This is Danny from the Harbor City Speakers Group in Baltimore, Maryland.
Danny Boyd, alcoholic.
What's up, dude?
Hey, guys. So, cool. So I'd like to thank Jeff for asking me to come out, and then he didn't. So that's sweet. So alcoholic, right? Pedigree, right? So Harbor City Speakers is my home group. We meet Thursday nights at 8:30 down at Federal Hill in Baltimore. It's right across the street from the Inner Harbor. It's an hour-long speaker meeting, very similar to this. And formerly, I used to say I could pretty much guarantee we'll have a speaker who has a message of hope, big book-based, carried with depth and weight. And since my sponsor moved to Florida, and they made me the new speaker scheduler, I can guarantee that our speakers are going to have a message of depth and weight, hope. Because that's the idea, there's real genuine hope here. And that's an absolutely beautiful thing. I didn't have any. That's my home group. I have a sponsor. I have the honor of sponsoring other men in this fellowship. Two of them agreed to ride up here with me, which is nice. My sobriety day is 8/8/2015. And that's not my first one, but if I can continue to keep doing the things that I've been doing, hopefully it's the last one. The only difference between me and a brand new guy is just consistently doing the same thing over and over again. It's beautiful. I don't know. I remember chasing the feeling of the first couple drunks all the way through it, and each time you give up a little bit more of yourself to try and hit that same buzz, but I'm getting drunk. I'm not getting that same relief I got the first couple times, and it costs more and more and more. And here in this fellowship, it just gets better and better and better. The more work that you put in, the relief I'm getting from this place is just instantly or infinitely growing. It's beautiful. So my name's, Danny Boyd. I grew up in an Irish Catholic family, and I've heard some people say, if you can remember your first drink, you might be an alcoholic. And I was man, I can't remember my first drink for the life of me. I've been polishing off my family members half empties forever. The Irish family, man, every time they'd throw a party, it was look at how sweet the bar is I put together, I know I was hammered at 13 at a grandparent's wedding anniversary, but I'm pretty positive I was drunk before then, because I was shooting for it. I was aiming to get somewhere when I was drinking my mom's champagne glasses while my grandfather wasn't paying attention. So I know, I've been drinking, I'm a drinker, love drinking. I love everything about drinking, honestly. The glasses that you drink out of, I love bars. They have the best commercials during football, the tub girls at the bar. I had so many Bud Light t-shirts when I got sober. It was ridiculous. I love it. I love that stuff, man. It works every time. It's like magic. So I just want to get that across, man. That it works. It worked every time, and I had a great time for a while, and the price tags I started paying for my alcoholism got too much for me to bear, and I had to give it up. 13. I can remember being hammered. Probably was hammered before that. Continued on that way for a long time. I didn't have lots of big consequences until the very end. Everything that I had were these near misses, right? Seconds and inches, all the way. Stuff that would terrify normal people, right? Muggles, as I like to call them. You wreck your car and everybody gets out and they're fine. And you're I'm a good drunk driver. Or you pass the sobriety test, pass. I did the sobriety test, and he was just man, how about you leave the car? And I was I'll leave. It'll stay, good deal. That stuff doesn't scare me. It emboldens me, I'm I'm good at this thing. And I continue on, I I lost my quadriplegic friend in New York City on New Year's Eve, like somewhere in Times Square. Found him. But like, that would terrify a lot. Everybody. That would terrify everybody. We were sleeping at his parents' house that night. You can't like show up to your friend's house like without their handicapped son. You know, found him. That was close. No big deal. We're all right. You know, moving on. That stuff didn't scare me. Looked like a good time when it was happening. And, you know, we laugh about it now. It's terrible. Oh, my God. I lost wheels. It was bad. You know, so at 19 years old, I realized I was, like, physically dependent on alcohol at the first time. This was gonna be the first time I was going to be out of the country, and I was going to be someplace else where you didn't have to be 21 to, like, purchase your own alcohol. And, you know, my critical thinking just pointed out, or I realized, you know, through other people's, other people tell me, you know, not my ally, you know, like the things I come up with don't turn out great. So I was like worried if I was in another country and I was, you know, trying to pick up a girl at the bar that she might be able to drink more than I could, or I couldn't handle mine. So I'll just drink every day for like the 90 days leading up to this vacation and get my tolerance up there. So I'm in, you know, the Caribbean, and I woke up one morning and I was not feeling well at all. I thought I was just really hungover, and my parents had like rented mopeds, you know, so they could tool about this island, and they were done with them, and they said that me and my buddies could have them if we like woke up at, you know, 8 in the morning and met them at the place where they rented them, and we passed a driving test. And that sounded like a great idea, like 10 p.m. the night before. And like when I woke up that morning, I was bad, like out of shape, you know. I did not want to go take a driving test at all. My friends that I brought with me were like, you know, we should probably go do some shots before we take this driving test in a country where they drive on the wrong side of the road. And I didn't even want to take shots. Like my plan, like I felt so hungover, I thought. My plan was to like take a shot and like throw up on my buddy Tristan. Like that was the plan. And what happened was we like went to the bar on the way to the driving test and started drinking, and like I immediately felt better. Like immediately, you know, I was hungry. My hand stopped shaking, and I felt all right, you know. And I was 19. And I'm 32 now, and like that's why I went through DARE, you know. And I was like, I think I might be physically dependent on alcohol, you know? And I'll have to deal with this one day. Not today, but one day. You know, morning beer is a must from here on out, no big deal. And continued on, you know? And that was it, man. Like lots of little things here and there that people on the outside looking in would be like, hey man, you might do this thing a little bit different than everybody else. The number of times you've had alcohol poisoning, or you gave up liquor for 2 years, you know, like, as soon as I turned 21, I realized that they could make it delicious. I was right back. I was a big fan of bottles that whistle when you squeeze them. I was talking about this the other night, and someone was like, remember the first time that somebody popped that plastic thing off, and you're like, oh, it's genius, I didn't even know it came off. Yeah. So, like, I drank, you know, and stuff didn't really, you know, I like, went to college, didn't go, like, I signed up, you know. I spent a year, like, in Towson, which is, like, a town north of Baltimore that's got, like, 5 colleges in it and 1 street of bars. So I had a good time there. And while I was there, me and my buddy got like a townhouse, and we had 1 parking spot for our townhouse. So whoever got home first got the spot, you know. And I don't leave bars before they close. I generally don't leave when they're closing. I know somebody there we're hanging out, but everybody else is leaving that last call. It's not for us. And so I was like driving home from the bar one day, and I had like a young lady with me, and my roommate had beat me home, so he had the spot. So I parked down the street. And we were at my house for a little while, and we're gonna go smoke a cigarette out front. And when I opened my front door, I saw like two two guys going through my roommate's car. And my car had been broken into like 3 times that year. And so I'm like, man, these guys must only be breaking into the car that's parked in this spot. It's them. Like, they're the ones, you know? And this poor girl has no idea. We didn't ride there in that car. It wasn't hard to break into my roommate's Jeep Wrangler with no top and no doors. You know? She just sees me like open the front door with like a lit cigarette and like see what's going on and like pitch the butt and like, yeah, like here we go. And I like bum rush these guys. And man, I was in marching band in high school. Like not by choice, you know? And I wrestled and I tried to box for a year, but it was awful. And I don't know, man. I don't know how good you are at fighting. I mean, fighting two guys at once is hard. And and one of them ran. Like, the one tapped his buddy and just took off. And the other guy kind of jumps out like, oh, my bad, I didn't know it's your car. My mistake, you know? And I just lay into this poor kid. I was like 22 or 23 at the time, and I'd be surprised if he was out of high school or just barely. And as I'm like, you know, mercilessly like hitting this poor kid on the ground, my head starts going, and I'm like, I'm gonna get his ID, and I'm gonna call the police, and I'm like a citizen's arrest, you know. Turns out that's kidnapping. You can't hold people against their will. So this is what's going on in my head, right? And we're talking about my head's not my best ally. And my head's like, get his ID and we'll call the cops and we'll get him, you know, ha. And what comes out of my mouth is like, give me your effing wallet, without the effing, you know? And right then, his buddy came back with like a tire iron or a crowbar. I don't know what. And luckily he hit me in the head, because he hit me in the leg with like sufficient force to break both the bones right under my knee. And like the two of them just like ran off into the night. And this poor girl who's just standing there comes running up like, what is going on? You know? Like, I'm calling an ambulance right now. I'm like, I'm totally fine. And I try to take the one step, and I was like, okay, no, hospital time, but no ambulance. And I just go wake up somebody big enough to carry me. I go to the hospital. And so this is like the first time for me, right? Since 19, I'm going to be like physically separated from alcohol for a little bit. Because what they told me is when you break bones that close to a joint, that you don't operate, you don't do surgery until the swelling goes down. So I had to like hang out in the hospital for a week. And this is my like first alcohol detox. And I'm here to report that when you're on a morphine drip, not that bad. I figured out exactly how often that drug worked, you know? Exactly how often. Because you'd hit it and you're like, it got real warm in here. You know, flushed a little bit, sweating. And there I am, like hanging out in this bed, just pressing that thing as often as I can. And I end up like having a surgery, and I used to have like a serious resentment against the surgeon. But like, he was a fantastic surgeon. He was like a sports medicine doctor. He worked in professional athletes. They put me back together better, you know, than I was before. He was like, you'll still be able to run, jump, and throw just like before. I was like, banned, you know. Can't do that anyway. Like, I don't have any pain now. Like, there's a plate and 5 screws in there, and I'd never know. You know, I have, like, a little spot where there's no feeling. You, like, pull out a leg hair, and I wouldn't feel it. That's it. That's the only, like, lingering effects I have from that. But back then, I guess it was before the opiate craze was kind of what it is now, you know? And he was just trying to be a good doctor, honestly. Prior to that, I didn't like opiates at all. I drank way too much, you know? Like, every time I'd take, like, a Percocet from like, you know, getting dental surgery or something like that, I would just throw up all over the place. And I was perfectly capable of throwing up on my own. Didn't enjoy them. I liked substances that made it so you could drink longer. I think if anybody was put on the amount of like painkillers he put me on, like they'd become physically dependent, whether you're an alcoholic or not. The problem is I suffer from like this spiritual malady, and like I'm just constitutionally like uncomfortable being me, you know, and sober. And And I remember like this exactly what he said. And he was like, "All right, Danny, so we're gonna put you on these pills," and it's like, he goes, "It's proven that pain causes stress." And I was like, "With you." And he goes, "Stress slows the healing process." And I was like, "Uh-huh." And he goes, "So you just take as many of these as you need, and it's very important you don't run out. Like, you have to call me. You'll be very sick if you run out." And I was like, "You got it, doc." You know. You know, so I took full advantage of that, and the story for that stuff was pretty like simple, to, like similar to everybody else's who has like the surgeries and stuff like that. Like, you know, you get put on the pills, and then like, you know, you shop around doctors a couple times, and they don't want to give them to you anymore, and you're buying them on the street, and, you know, that sort of thing. And I always said, like, as soon as I could walk again, like crush myself around, I started drinking. But like, you think back and things get a little bit clearer. But that's not even true. Like, my buddy turned 21 when I like couldn't even crutch myself around. So like, I called my cousin with cerebral palsy and like borrowed her wheelchair to go to the bar for my buddy's 21st birthday. So I started drinking again before I could even walk, you know. And then as soon as I could crutch myself around, I was drinking every day, and now I'm taking these pills every day, and now I got like this dual addiction going. And you know, I'm grateful for it now, man. It brought me to my knees real quick. And like I was saying before, it was like the standard story. You shop at the doctors, you buy them on the street, and then one day I'm sitting with my guy in the car, and he's like, "Oh yeah, I forgot, I don't have any more, you know, Percocets." And I was like, "Why are we here?" And he was just like, "Well, I got a big bag of heroin." And I was like, "So if I take that, I won't, like, you know, throw up and have diarrhea at the same time?" And he was like, "Yeah." And I was like, "One heroin, please." You know? Mentioned the fence, gone. Line in the sand, out the window. You know, I'm not going to do street drugs, prescriptions. You know, like, there's no quality control there. You have no idea what you got until you put it in you. So like, there it goes, right? Now I'm doing that and drinking every day. And that got dark, man. Those years were rough. That was, you know, like 22, broke my leg, and then like 29 was the first time I got sober, or 28. And yeah, things went rough. You know, I stopped going to the bar as often. Like, and I love the bar. I really do. I think I'm a big shot. I, like, meet the bartender, so you get drinks for half price, but then you pretty much, like, if it was a $100 bill at a normal bar, but he's your guy, so it's only $50, and, but then you tip him $50, you know? It's like, the same money anyway. Like that. I love that stuff, man. And it just turned into, like, you know, those things, and then vodka at home, and all I did was go to work. You know, I was working at like this law firm, or it was a process service company. And, like, we sent out the guys to like serve people papers, and over the course of like the 5+ years I worked there, we started with like four employees, and we had like 20 some by the time I was fired. It made me like one of three managers, and in the beginning we're like figuring this thing out, you know, as we're going along. It was all just 20-something-year-old guys, and we were kind of splitting like the bookkeeping, you know, responsibilities. Like, everybody just sort of pitching in, and just at one point they were like, "Man, you should be like the full-time bookkeeper." And I was like, "I don't know anything about that." And they were like, "Well, you're a debt collector, so you know accounts receivable. Just learn payable. Good." And I was like, my own office, a computer with two screens and QuickBooks, and a copy of that book, QuickBooks for Dummies. And I'm now the accounts manager, you know, of this company. And like, for several, I mean, it was the last 2 years I was there. So it was for like 3+ years, like, I didn't steal like a cent, like not one. And as this thing progressed, you know, it was very easy for me to cut myself extra paychecks, so I cut everybody else's. And I did every day, you know. I went on like another vacation. I had like bad luck on that, and I came back, and the owner of the company had like one check in front of him, just one. He was like, "I don't particularly recall this one," and I'd talked my way out of this before. Like, there were legitimate reasons for me to cut myself like an extra paycheck. Like, if my process server or courier didn't show up, and I had to take my own vehicle to like take documents or affidavits wherever they had to go, you get reimbursed for that type of thing at that company, It was like, you know, one of the first, like, God shots, God moments, whatever. Because this isn't my standard thing. I had talked my way out of these things before. And for whatever reason, I was, like, just broken enough, just tired of everything. Where I was like, "Man, I've been stealing from you for, like, 2 years straight. I don't know how much money it is because I don't want to know. And I'm like a degenerate, like heroin addict, alcoholic, and I don't know how to stop. So I think I got to go to rehab or something. Here's exactly how you can figure it out. Here's how I stole it. I don't know. And this beautiful man was just like, you're fired. And then he paid for like my medical insurance for another 2 months so I could go to treatment. Those treatment centers are fast, dude. As soon as you call them, they're like, we have a plane ticket for you to Texas tomorrow. And you're like, not so willing anymore. So I go to Texas, right? I'm going to go to the late night commercial you see. Like, you know, we'll fix you. I go down to Texas, like my first rehab. And like, this is my first stint, you know, at trying to be sober, at detoxing, right? And like AA and 12-step and all that, you know? Because everything I knew about 12-step I learned from movies and television, like Fight Club, you know? Like, we're going to pair up, we're going to circle, and we're going to cry. And like, I didn't want that, you know? I don't want what y'all have, no. Like, I didn't know what y'all had, you know? I had no idea. And it turned out not to be that, which is nice. So like I go down to Texas and I walk into the rehab and like I'm broken, man. Like I am not. I'm terrified. I'm utterly terrified. Absolutely convinced the amount of like illegal drugs I am doing every day is a problem. Not convinced I wanted to quit drinking, but I'm in there. I'm gonna do whatever y'all say. Give it a go, you know. Because I don't know what else to do anymore. I've tried like so many of like the psychiatrists and like the meds and like all of that, man. It didn't pan out, you know, for longer than like a day. It's like I walk in and I'm honest, right? And first you do the intake assessment, right, with like your counselor. And this guy like hustled me right from the start. And he was like, so standard thing's like 28 days here. It's been 28 days since like the 80s. You're a pretty sick dude. Thinking like 60. And I was like, that sounds like a lot. And he was like, how about 45? And I was like, I can do 45. He's like, great, your insurance already approved 45. So like he like shot high to like get me right in there, which is great. When I love my sponsees, they're like, that rehab lied to me. And I'm like, good, they should. You don't know what you need, you know? And we don't, you know, I don't know what I am. You know. I had no idea. So I'm in this rehab. It's very, very nice. And it's like one building deal. Like you don't leave the building for the whole time you're there. On day 29, I'm like really angry, like really angry. You know, now people who showed up after me are leaving before me. I'm the only patient out of like 150 people there agreed to stay for longer than 28 days. The only one. And they did not develop a 45-day like workbook just for me. So like on day 29, like they're just like flipping to a page, and I'm like, man, I did this, you know? Like I killed it. I was after the detox. I was loving rehab, you know? Like, you know, eat here, do that there, go to class, then group, and we're gonna start a peer counseling group because y'all need my help. And community leader, you know it, and like, you know, like all that stuff. Like I'm digging, And like day 29, they're just flipping to the start thing. And I'm like, I did the workbook. It's like filled out and graded, you know? And I'm going nuts after like 3-4 days of just doing the same thing. And when I first got there and I was like detoxing, I met the clinical director of their outpatient, which was like in the same building, you know? And James was from Louisiana and we were in Texas. And I was trying to do his accent. He saw me like walking down the detox hallway doing it. Like I wear my hat to like hide my face from the world. I'm trying to go smoke a cigarette when you're allowed to smoke cigarettes outside and doing that like shuffle, you know. And he saw me like walking down the hallway and he's just bubbly and happy, you know, and sober, and comes up to me and like grabs me by the arms like this, points my hat like straight forward and up so people can see me, and he goes like, we're here to make changes, brother, and like hugs me. And I continued on his merry way. And I was like, oh, God, I don't like that guy one bit. You know? If I'm not detoxing, you don't know me. I don't want anything you have. Don't tell me that the Ativan is not that bad coming up. Man, leave me alone. You know, I'm not open for it yet. And I wasn't at that point. And over the course of, like, me being there for, like, the you know, couple weeks, James would come have lunch with, like, the patients who were in the inpatient, you know, facility. And he would sit and talk with us. And it was, like, obvious to me that he, like, drank and, you know, did drugs and everything like that, the way I did. And he obviously hadn't for a while, because he's now, like, the clinical director of an outpatient facility. And that's a decent amount of school, you know. But, like, but he seemed happy, right? He seemed content, you know. Peace, right? He had it. And I was, like, sitting with him at lunch one day, and I was probably complaining about the fact I'm doing this workbook a second time. And I asked him, I was like, do you think I'd come do, like, IOP while I'm here, you know, still living in rehab? And without any skipping a beat, he was like, yeah, absolutely, come on by. We'll do you in the morning with the IOP guys. We'll do the morning classes. And then we're done. You can go back to rehab. And so I got to go to IOP. And everybody else would drive themselves to IOP because they don't live in rehab. And I would walk over. And it was, like, very different from any of the ones I'd done before since then. They do this thing in the South called, like, sick man or stick man, depending on where you're at. Or, like, they do the first three steps with you without you realizing you're doing it. And they would listen to a lot of speaker tapes, and then they would go, like, outside meetings. Like, everybody else would drive themselves, and I would ride with this guy, James. And he bought me, like, cigarettes and coffee, and he's my introduction to this thing. Like, you know, the 12 steps, you know. Just living it, showing me. And over the course of me being there for, like, the next 2 weeks, you hear a lot, like, find a sponsor who has what you want. And like I said earlier, I was convinced the amount of, like, illegal drugs I was doing was probably a bad idea. Not convinced drinking, maybe smoking weed, wasn't out of the question moving forward. So, like, me picking a sponsor who had what I want, like, I wanted to be drunk. So, like, I had the clarity enough to go, like, I don't think I should pick the guy. And I asked James. I was, like in the middle of process group or whatever. And I said, James, like, who do you know in Baltimore? I got to go back home to Baltimore. Who do I call? And he, like, stops group. You know, everybody else is doing their, like, daily check-in. And James just pulls out his phone and, like, calls a guy. He goes, yeah, I got a guy. He seems pretty willing. He'll be here which day? He'll be home on this day. And he goes, uh-huh. Yeah, sure. And, like, hands me the phone. And this guy on the other end, he's like, so you're going to be home on this day? And I was like, yeah. And he goes, fantastic. I'm going to pick you up. We're going to go to a meeting in Philadelphia. And I was like, great. No meetings in Baltimore, I guess. And I go home. And I give the phone back to James after we make our plans, right? And I write it down, like, my rehab notebook. And James, and he's, like, laughing, and he's joking, he's smiling. All right, you know, talk to you later. Hangs up the phone, he looks at me, and he goes, huh. He's, like, giddy. He's like, you have no idea what's coming. No idea. Oh, man. Steve is the next Navy fighter pilot. He's not going to take any of your crap. He's going to whip you through all 12 steps. You're going to be so happy, joyous, and free afterward. You're going to be helping so many new guys. Oh, you don't even know it's coming. You don't even know. And he just, like, continues on with group, you know? And so I think, like, Maverick or Iceman is going to pick me up to take me to my first meeting. And, like, the guy that shows up is, like, this, he's, like, a little bit short, a little bit pudgy, soft-spoken gay dude with, like, I can see the kind eyes, like, right from the beginning, man. I don't know. It was, like, peace. You know, people say, like, they glow or whatever. I mean, the guy, like, hummed. Like, when he walked past, it was like, you know? Like, grace, you know? And I'm riding with this guy up to this meeting in Philadelphia. And so, I don't represent my sponsorship family. I don't represent, like, my home group or anything. I represent, like, Danny Boyd, my experience. And I know there's a lot of different ways to go through the steps. And what he did was, like, on the ride to Philadelphia, 1, 2, and 3, you know? And I didn't know he was doing it either. Like, he's covert like that, you know? It was, like, just kind of, how do you feel when this happens and when you're sober and not sober? And bad case of sobriety, not a drinking problem. I'm like, I never thought of it that way. And when he's speaking at this meeting in Philadelphia, and it's, like, the first time this meeting's ever happened, and he's the speaker they wanted for the first one, and I'm like, great, I'm the godfather of Baltimore AA, driving me around. And do the meeting, I don't remember anything that happened there. And then we drive back, and on the drive back, we're, like, continuing talking, you know? And I don't know why, like, I trusted this guy. I really don't. I was, like, just broken, just beaten enough to, like, yeah, my plans for living have not been panning out, you know? And the way you talk about when you're sober like before a spiritual experience, that's how I feel right now. And if you could help me not feel like this forever, that'd be great, you know, because it's bleak, you know. And he's like giving me instructions on how I'm going to do a third step like that night. And I'm going to call him tomorrow. He's going to tell me how I'm going to write my fourth step. And I'm like, that seems fast. And he was like, based on what experience? And none, you know, I don't know. People told me in rehab, you know? And so I'm moving through this stuff, moving, you know? And like I said, I had enough willingness and stuff like, and knew, I didn't know anything about this deal. I didn't know anything about being sober. So like they said, go to an IOP. So I went to one. And you get out of rehab, you go to IOP. I'm like, all right. And I'm at one, and like these are good intentioned, well-meaning people with like lots of letters after their name, and like your insurance, and you are paying them lots of money to like take care of you and help you put your life back together. And I know they help lots of people. And I think the problem is when they come across like somebody like me, like this spiritual malady alcoholic, and they're telling me things like, you know, watch your triggers in slippery places, And like the trigger list made no sense. No sense. Like I'm going to see like, you know, I don't know, like a beer commercial and be like, no, and then get hammered. Like, you know, like, what are your triggers? Like air, you know, like consciousness. If I wake up and there's a ceiling or there isn't one, you know, like I don't like this right now, you know, so let's get out of it. And like they kept telling me things like I was too sick to help myself and I shouldn't be sticking my hand out to others and two sickies don't make a welly, you know, that sort of stuff. And like good advice, I guess, you know. So I'm like going through these 12 steps with my sponsor and shortly thereafter the traditions and then right after that the history of AA, which turned out to include the Oxford Group and the Washingtonian Temperance Society. And then I didn't help anybody. No one. I don't know where I heard it, but there's like good 12-steppers and bad ones. And I was like, I'm going to be a bad sponsor. So I'll make coffee. You know, like I thought that counted. And if that works for you, spectacular, man. It didn't work for me. I made like 9 months. And I drank again. And as soon as I get drunk, I was like, you know, it'd be a great idea. Heroin. So I get arrested in Park Heights in Baltimore on the day of the Baltimore riots. And, you know, went to jail. And that whole head full of AA and belly full of booze done mixed, you know, they never lie here. I was so angry y'all ruined drinking for me. Like, so angry. I was stealing money from like my boss every day, and he was paying me way more than I deserved. And like every day I did it, and I would go, you know, cobble together everything I needed to feel okay for that day. And as I'm like drinking myself into a stupor that night, I feel awful. I've stolen this money, and I'm positive I'm not going to do it again tomorrow. Like that's what drugs and like alcohol, all that stuff. You know, sex, pretty girl, nice car, that all worked for like the night. Tomorrow, I'm going to fix all this stuff. I'm convinced, like I'm confident, tomorrow's it, I'm not gonna do this again tomorrow. And then like I was saying earlier, I just wake up covered in Danny Boyd, and then I drink and, you know, all right again. And there I am, like arrested on the day of the Baltimore riots in a cell, and I'm like the one white guy, and terrified, you know, race riots are going on outside. And the little cell was like 8 people, and luckily these guys are saying things like, man, I'm not gonna like do anything against this kid because of the color of his skin, get more sentence on my, more time in my sentence. And I'm like, oh thank God, you know, like you want my bologna sandwich they gave me. And then they move you into like the big holding cell where everybody's waiting to see the commissioner, and that's like 50-60 people at Central Booking in Baltimore, and a lot of them know they're not gonna make bail or like get out, you know. And every time they'd like kind of get mad at me and like, you know, kind of this guy over there. Somehow we all figure out, or man, who knows? Well, I feel bad for this guy now. But like, they said the one guy who was a child molester, like in the corner. So every time they were like, you know, screw this white boy, and they'd all kind of bum rush me, I'd be like, go get the chomo. And like, you know, diversion, you know? And so like I go see the commissioner, and at this point, it's been made apparent to me that I embezzled $80,000. And like I had the lawyer and everything like that, and he was like, "Man, you're just a really sick kid, and I can swing this. You know, if you don't get arrested again before your court date, man, I can keep you out of prison." And like the original charge was like 2 to 10, and I don't want to go to prison. And they like switched it to a theft charge. It was embezzlement. They switched it to theft, which had no minimum but like a max of 15. And I thought that was a terrible idea. And the deal was, just don't mess up before your court date and you don't go to prison. And that's why I had like a serious problem. And like these IOPs and like these process groups, stuff like that, where people were like, you know, just don't drink or use no matter what. And I was like, man, apparently you and I have a very different thing going on. Like, I drink and use no matter what. No matter what. No matter the consequences you lay out in front of me, eventually it's going to look like a good idea or I'm not going to get caught. You know, like that's what happens to me. I'm looking at 15 years in prison, and I was like, meh. Get drunk, you know, like just boom, in. And there I am arrested. And girlfriend's not gonna bail me out. Family ain't gonna come help me. They're furious. And the commissioner let me go on my own recognizance. I didn't even have to post bail. Like I had a pending $80,000 theft case, like a court date and everything. And she was just like, make it to your court date, have a good day, and sent me on my way. Like, they must have needed room. Thank God I got arrested on the day of the Baltimore riots, you know? I don't know anybody else that's happened to. And so I get out, and I do what we do, call mom and sleep on their couch until I can get into another rehab. The lawyer's like, you need to go to this one. This is the best one in these judges' eyes, you know? Get in. And so I go to another one, and like, I was only there for 28 days this time. But I go to this place, and it's like right when you walk in the door, like they're putting you to service. If you've been in rehab for like 5 days, you're now an old timer. And like, you know, you got to show the new guys around. And from the moment you're in this place, you're like, you're put to work, you know, helping others. And it's got a strong sense of community. And like the spirituality is like almost tangible in the air. I met some really cool guys there. It was a larger crew, but like I still got two friends that like I went through rehab with who are still sober now. And second I get out of there, right? I'm living in a halfway house now because my family, they tell your family, like, if you have drugs or alcohol in the house and the patient's coming home to your house, you should probably get rid of your drug or your alcohol. You know? And my dad was just like, well, what'd I do with my bar? He ain't coming home, you know? So I end up at a halfway house. First day at the halfway house, I call a sponsor up, you know, and he comes and picks me up, and he takes me to a different halfway house in Baltimore, a chip house, and he goes, I'm going to take these guys up buy some groceries. This is Chris. Chris has been kicked out of the chip house for using and stealing. He's not allowed anywhere except this common room where they have the meetings. Keep an eye on Chris. I'll be back. And I was like, man, Steve, I've been sober like 29 days today. And he was like, perfect. He doesn't have 29 minutes. Give him some hope. See him. And like left me with him. You know? So like first day out of rehab, I'm put to service, helping others. And that was like the start of it for me, man. You know, I put the car back together, started driving, and I was told, you know, hey, my car, it's God's car. I'm very lucky to have that car. If I go to a meeting by myself, it's pretty selfish. There's tons of guys who need to go to meetings and don't have ways to get there. And I was like talking with my sponsor probably like 2 months out of rehab. Like, I feel worse now than I did before. And I was like, can't start helping the guys, you know, have to. And he introduced me to some guys who were living down at the Helping Up Mission. Actually, he introduced me to my buddy Greg Howard. And he just started, man, like filling my car. It's like filling the car. And that was a start. Like consistently showing up for these guys, you know. So I feel like our homes are like designed to make us never want to leave, you know. I got like the nice couch, good TV, Xbox, dog. I'm gonna hang out here all night, you know. And And when like there's guys counting on you to pick them up and take you out and about, you know, your feet, you know, feet first, there you go. So you train your feet to do the stuff you're supposed to be doing when your head's telling you otherwise. And you look up and you're out doing it, you know. Man, I don't feel like going to meetings today, and you're driving down the road to like the Helping Up mission to pick up guys. That was it, man. That was like my first service commitment, you know, like just the unofficial one. I'm going to pick guys up and we're going to meetings. And now the rides to and from were better than the meetings anyway. I had a blast doing that stuff and like consistently showing up for these guys like over and over and over again. And it was like I get these like tangential sponsees, you know, like not the guys I'm picking up every week. They'd call me and go, hey, there's a newer guy at the mission. And can I bring him along? And I'm like, yeah, I'll save him a seat too. And he'd bring him along, and they'd be like, you know, you should ask be your sponsor, Danny. He shows up when he says he'll be here. And I start getting sponsees through, like, the guys I've just been picking up. And then that chip house, the halfway house I was at the first day out of rehab, just to hang. I go there to, like, you know, meet the sponsor. He's at their group conscience. And I'm just trying to, like, talk to him afterward. And I'm sitting in for this group conscience. And they're like, so Angelo chairs the Monday night meetings, and he's moving to Colorado. And Danny has substituted for him like 3 times. So we're going to go ahead and have Danny do the new Monday night speaker meeting. And does anyone oppose? No. Good. Danny, you're secretary on Monday nights. And I was like, what happened? You know, like, I need 52 friends now. And they just lay it out in front of you, you know, and you just got to go. And so it's so, like my first home group being sober this time around was this little halfway house meeting that I didn't even live in. And because my buddy did it for me, he had me speak there when I had like 60 days. I did the same thing because there's a lot of guys that are like real excited about recovery. And they've been through these things before and they don't get opportunities to speak at groups a lot. And so that's what I started doing. Started grabbing these guys and hey man, you want to speak at Chip House? They're like, man, I'm like 3 months sober. It's like, perfect. They don't have 3 minutes, you know? Come on down. And when I asked a lot of new guys to do that stuff, they would flake out pretty often. And so I got a lot of practice speaking at podiums, honestly. Y'all do the same thing too. Like you say, I'll be there, I'll see you then. And then you don't answer your phone or text message that day. And then the next morning, you're like, oh, I forgot. I'm like every one of you does this the next morning. Nobody answers the phone that night. That was my first home group. And I start getting these like tangential, like, you know, sponsees. And I'm walking other guys through this thing. That was like over like two and a half years ago. And I had like the same sponsor, and I went to a lot of the same meetings, you know, and the crews you roll around with, they change, but there's a lot of the same guys there, and the only difference I can look at, right, between like the first time I tried to get sober and now, is I started helping other guys. That's it. That's the only thing I got. Everything else is pretty much the same. Like, that's where the relief is, you know, like when all else fails, intensive work with other alcoholics, right? And that's not like a sentence, you know. I was talking with Rob about it, you know. So like if you do your inventories and prayer and meditation and stuff like that, like you'll probably be okay for the night. But when all else fails, if you're not keeping up with that stuff, go grab a new alcoholic. You'll be good. And that was it. And like my sponsor says, if something feels good, I get excessive, and I did, man. I was like just running around crazy, you know, sponsoring everybody and shouting about how I don't sponsor sponsees, I sponsor sponsors, get some sponsees, you know, and things like that. And, man, I love this deal. I really do. So I was running around being sober, doing this this next right thing, you know, like just consistently showing up when I say I'm going to be somewhere. And when I get like $3 extra back for a pack of cigarettes when I was living in that halfway house doing the first sober job, and I'm like, sweet, I can get 3 more McDouble at lunch tomorrow, you know? Like, and then going back in and giving the woman a 7-Eleven those $3, and like everyone in line thinks I'm crazy, like in Baltimore, like this kid's an idiot. And because that little stuff matters, man. Like it's real easy for me to call these guys and be like, hey, I'm not gonna make it tonight, long day at work. Sorry guys, gotta cancel. That matters. Like, that's huge. Just doing these next right things over and over and over again, and my life just fell together. It's amazing. Through no action of my own, right? Just like, just trying to do this thing, like live a principled life, my life just fell together. I the girlfriend said I could move back into our apartment, which is pretty sweet. And then after a little while, we were like, for a little bit more money, man, we could afford a mortgage. So we bought a house. And I was sick and tired of working in offices like the debt collection and the process service. So I talked to somebody I knew who owned some restaurants, and I was like, who's your electrician? I just want to talk to him. Like, how do you do that? You know, what would you do differently now? And when I sat and met with this guy, he offered me a job. So now I have a career I've been doing for like 2+ years. And I didn't meet him to ask for a job. I met him to ask how he went about it, and I ended up with a career, you know? And the girlfriend, man, that was a coin toss if she was gonna stick around, you know? And Christmas Eve, she's now a fiance, and we have a house. And that court date, man, like, you don't get to talk to your former employer when you're like the defendant and he's like the lead witness for the prosecution, you know? And so we hadn't spoke. And this guy, the judge was like, what do you think? And he was like, well, he looks better than I've ever seen him. He seems to be doing well. He'd been paid back. Like my folks like retired early and remortgaged the house, and my brother and sister-in-law threw $10,000 at it, and like they paid this guy. And he was like, the rest of his life is gonna be paying his parents back, and it's gonna be a lot easier if he's not a convicted felon. So give him the opportunity. He's a terrible criminal. We'll catch him anyway if he messes up. And the judge went for it. Like, I stole $80,000. I didn't serve any prison time. I don't know. Like, just this consecutive stuff, man. The next right thing, over and over and over again. And, man, my life fell together. It fell together fast, too. I can't believe this stuff. Like, talk about the rocket ship ride, right? Fourth dimension. I'm here. It's great. You know? I don't know. This stuff. If you're struggling with this thing, like, there's a lot of people who I know would be honored to help you through this thing. And I used to think about, like, my sponsors, like, saving my life, you know? And he just taught me a new way to live mine. So I was all right. The whole idea was like, you know, if you're dependent on me, man, I'm going to fail you sooner or later. And my job is to take your hand and put it in God's hand. And if I can get you square with that, you're going to be okay. Do these consistent actions over and over again, you're going to get the same result, you know? I remember when I sat down with him in that halfway house, and I was like, you know, right out of the rehab with that kid Chris, and I'm like, step work again, now. Like, that felt good last time, because it does feel good going through, like, the steps the first time with a sponsor. You get, like, a relationship with another person who just wants you to do well, you know? He doesn't want anything from you. And you get a little bit of, like, you know, you look at yourself in ways that you haven't thought about before. And, like, there's great relief in that, where, like, things get put to words that I've been thinking for a long time and haven't been able to, like, articulate. And so I was like, let's do that step work again. And he was like, I'm not going to waste your time or my time. And I was like, insulted, you know? I was like, that's not the party line for AA. Your relapse is supposed to do this again. And he was like, where? Show me where. You know? I don't know, man. You know this book better than me. And so like he was like, look, man, you want to write a new inventory? You can write a new inventory. We can do that, you know, based on the last like 9 months or whatever. But these are principles, right? Principles apply to everybody, whether you're aware of them or not. And so what I just think you should do is act like you're aware. Because you're aware. You know. You've been through the steps. You want any refreshers on anything? Happy to do it. Get a sponsee and want to talk about like the first couple steps? Let's do that too. But me sitting here and doing that with you all over again, wasting your time, wasting my time. And yeah, I remember I was like not telling the girlfriend or my therapist my sponsor won't do step work again. That's not what he was doing. He was like, man, I gave you the knowledge. Like, you got it. It ain't going to help. Are you going to do the stuff or not? Move your feet. You know, and you're new, you're like, I'm do. But like, I followed through, and man, I love this thing. I really do. The peace that I have most of the time is incredible. And I don't know how this stuff works. I don't even know why, you know. I can't like point at like, you know, seven step then obsession relieved. Don't care. Don't care why I'm alcoholic, you know. One of my favorite speakers talks about, you know, standing in front of a house with a fire hose that's burning down and being like, I am not putting out the fire till you guys tell me who lit the candles. You know, what could be less important? Doesn't matter to me. You know, I'm alcoholic. Here now, and I'm comfortable now. You know, that's all I was looking for. That's it. Be okay right here, right now. You know, I love AA, man. I love the 12 steps. I'm so eternally grateful for like this opportunity, this life that I've been given. I wouldn't change like any of this for the world. Like, man, the first time I got sober, I didn't tell anybody I stole all that money except for like my sponsor and my lawyer. Like, that was it. And this time around, man, I tell everybody. Felony embezzler, you know? Greatest asset I got. Greatest one I got. It's amazing how many people have similar stories to this stuff. Like, the things that are like your darkest moments out there, like, that's it, man. That's the ammunition for the new guys. Just like I was saying, man, I love this thing. I love AA. I love all of you, and there's like nothing you can do about it. Thank you so much.